In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manicero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manicero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcast, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G-S, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, I am really stoked about today's guest. So many of you have written and, shared with us that, the frustrations of sometimes getting launched into real estate investing, especially when you're still working and you've got a full-time job, and even people that are retired, just trying to be able to plug in the time and make it possible for you to jump into real estate investing. Well, this next guest has been working full time throughout, we'll find out if it's been the entire real estate investing career here. Dr. Jeanette Birnbach has been a chiropractor and clinical nutrition provider for 24 years. Currently living and working outside Seattle, she is a real estate investor for 10 years. She has been an active investor and syndicator for 2 years with Blue Ring Investors. She has been married 23 years and has a 16-year-old daughter. Well, Jeanette, welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network.
I am so happy to be here. I cannot tell you how long I've been waiting to get the chance to talk to you here.
I am so stoked about this. One, I'm a big chiropractic fan and have been for years. I know how pressing and how busy chiropractors are. And to hear that you have grown this investor portfolio during that time of having a very active practice is very intriguing to me, and I want to hear your story. But I'd like you to take it back a bit. How did you I don't know if you've always been from the Seattle area, or maybe where were you before you came there, if not, and how you how you got into the profession and before you became an investor and so forth.
Sure. Yeah. I have a pretty typical Generation X story where we were told, go to school, right? Get your education, get a good job, save your money, work for 40 years for a company, and maybe one day retire. So that was the story that most of us heard. And so I did that. I went to school, I got the good education. I finished that education though, and I went to Penn State University. I'm originally from outside Philadelphia and a Penn State grad, but I didn't know what to do, honestly, when I graduated. I wasn't sure. So the good job part was the part where I got stuck. So instead of not knowing what to do in the United States, I moved to Japan, and I decided I would just go to Japan and not know what to do there. So I moved.
Wow.
And I went with a couple of friends. We were all working as English teachers, which was a real typical way to get there. at that time. This would have been in the early 90s. And it was truly a transformative and amazing time. And it ultimately impacted my going into healthcare. So I was living in a house, and my neighbors on both sides were over 100 years old. And wow. They gardened, and they did tea ceremony, and they were completely independent. They got their own groceries. And my idea of what it meant, you know, to be older was so changed by what I saw. And to stay healthy that way, they were exercising, and they were doing different types of natural treatments. So they would do acupuncture and chiropractic work and Tai Chi and just different ways to maintain their health that were mainstream there, where here they're not as mainstream and people tend to have to go somewhere and pay for them. Where in Japan, every morning, we as a little community did Tai Chi in the courtyard of the elementary school that was right next to my house. That was every morning.
How cool.
So these things were just normal there. And I watched my 102-year-old neighbor do a limbo, you know, at a party. So it made me think very differently about what health and healthcare looked like. And so after 4 years in Japan, I came back to the United States, and that's when I decided to go to chiropractic college. So it you know, really determined my path there. Now, after I got into the chiropractic work, so it's 3.5 years of school. We go year round in that field. They have a trimester system. I got into practice, and that I still nothing to do with real estate yet, but the first lesson that helped me later in real estate occurred at that time. So I was on the East Coast, and I had a practice outside Philadelphia. My husband and I practiced together. He went to school with me. We graduated together. And about 3 years into it, Blue Cross Blue Shield, which was one of the main providers at that time on the East Coast, very suddenly decided they weren't going to cover as many services as they had previously been covering. And I watched a lot of practices really suffer and several close because they could not weather that storm. So they had, you know, maybe they loved their job, but they just had the one stream of income. And they were thinking about their business in terms of providing good care, but they weren't thinking about their business in terms of how to weather a storm if something like that were to suddenly happen, because we had no indication that this was coming. There was no warning about this. So that was the first time where I really saw that having backup systems or some other stream of income would be really important.
A clinical nutrition provider too. Now,
yes.
was that something you started at the beginning, or were you looking for another stream of income at that time?
That was more just out of the passion for learning how to do it. It does provide a second stream of income, and maybe subconsciously I was aware of that, but that was just more a fascination with that as a healing method. And it allowed me to move more into where I am today in practice, which is more of a clinical nutrition base. I went back to school and I did more education, and I got a master's degree in human nutrition. And so I was able to help more people who were dealing with chronic illness. So currently, that's kind of the bulk of what I do in my work, helping people that have fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, suffering from chronic diseases like Lyme and Epstein-Barr infections, and supporting those people that sometimes fall through the cracks in the medical system or who aren't as fully supported in that system as they'd like to be. They want to kind of take some of it into their own hands. And so we can facilitate that.
Well, that's great. It sounds like a more holistic approach. And, you know, I know with healthcare that is really key, not just, you know, getting medication and trying to treat whatever's happening just with that, you know, that usually there's a cause, you know, that initiated that. If you can treat the cause as opposed to the symptom, I know, you know, personally that's a lot more effective. So that's yeah. great.
It was my time in Japan again that influenced that, right? It just kind of, you know, set my sail in that direction. And right around that time too, so this was, we're in early 2001, 2002, was when I picked up the book that everybody mentions and you've heard about, the cash flow quadrant. Mm-hmm. I picked up that book at that time, and also Robert Allen's book, Multiple Streams of Income, which I think was published the same year. It's a big, thick book. It's full of information, and it doesn't get the same exposure that Cash Flow Quadrant does for some reason. But it's an excellent book, and both of those really influenced me at that time and kind of jolted me out of that, you know, X-Gen upbringing of work hard, save your money, you know, put everything in the bank, and into thinking more as an entrepreneur.
And real estate obviously stood out, and well, I know in Kiyosaki's book, that's definitely his focus. Had you had any kind of experience with real estate, or is it you just kind of started from scratch?
I don't know if I had a light bulb moment with it. I just was always interested in real estate. It always seemed like a good idea. Everything I ever heard or read about it was good. So it was just kind of a natural progression. And then I moved, we actually left the Philadelphia area and we moved to Charleston in those early 2000 years, to Charleston, South Carolina. And it was easier than ever to become fascinated with real estate there, because it's so beautiful there. And there's so many beautiful houses and properties and architecture. And so I think it would be impossible to live there and not think about real estate. So that helped as well. I still was not investing at that time in Charleston, because I was busy starting the second practice, and I got a jet ski, there were other things kind of taking up my time. And also there wasn't the support at that time to become an investor that we have now. So there weren't podcasts, right? There weren't as webinars and books and the kind of things that we have now that can support us. So I didn't have any belief in myself that I could make that leap. I thought, I'm a chiropractor, I'm in healthcare, this is my lane, and that's a different lane. And I can't do these at the same time. So it just didn't occur to me. And I hadn't bumped into anyone in my life who said, wait, you can do this if you want to. Of course you could. Why not? So it was something I thought, oh, I'd really love to do that, but just didn't believe that I could. So after that, I was in Charleston then for 3 years, and then we moved to Florida. So this was to take a teaching job. I had a clinic. This would be my third now that I opened in Tampa. And I took a teaching job, and I also had my daughter at that time. So now I'm really busy starting the third practice, teaching on the weekends and running a clinic during the week. So again, I was thinking about real estate, not doing it. I was solidly on the S of the cash flow quadrant, which was good, but still not thinking about it. And then after two and a half years in Florida, we moved to Seattle, which is where we are now. And we've been ever since. So we got to Seattle in about 2006, when my daughter was one, and I had my fourth practice. I had associates in there. So I was really busy with a young kid and that. And I loved my job. I loved it. And one thing I would say to listeners, if they also love their job, is it's actually an easy way to get burned out when you love your work. Where it's easy to think about exit strategies or retiring if you don't like your work. But if you do, you're pouring so much into it that it may even be, you know, as fast or faster a track to burnout sometimes. So you need to have an exit strategy and these backup systems, and I would say passive income, especially if you love your job. And I learned that at that time. So I did go through a phase that I would call burnout, and had to get real serious about, you know, taking care of my health and what I needed to do to take breaks so that I would be available to help these other people and be there for my husband and my daughter. And I also started around that time listening to podcasts. So you can kind of see in a way the straight line to where I am now. It just all started coming together about that time.
Well, just to clarify here too, so you had these different practices. Now, when you moved, you would you would leave that other office and it would still be under your management, or did you, or were these all just separate practices, not maintaining all of them at the same time?
They were separate, and we sold them before we would move on.
Okay, got it.
And I love, one reason I ended up in Seattle, I would have probably gone back to South Carolina, back to Charleston, but when you sell a practice, you sign a non-compete clause. And so I wasn't away from South Carolina long enough to go back without breaking that aspect of the contract. So that was one way that we ended up in Seattle. We do like it here, and it's a great place to grow up. My 16-year-old is definitely very happy here. Whatever they want to do, it's available in this Seattle area.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a beautiful part of the country, yeah.
And once things were stable out here and she was a little older, that's when I finally could get into real estate, and I started with a house flip.
Oh, okay. So and just out of curiosity, with your practices, were you leasing in each case with your practices? You just, you know, leased an office space, or did you ever actually purchase the building where your practice was?
I only leased space. In Seattle, with our current investing with Blue Ring and even my own personal investments, they're all out of Washington. It's harder to make numbers work here. Mm-hmm. That being said, if I, you know, could do it over, I probably would have tried to purchase the office building where I worked, knowing what I know now. But when I first got out here, I had not done any work in real estate yet. And I didn't know that I could jump into that or that I was even capable of something like that. But I did think that I could do a house flip.
Awesome.
So that was my first, you know, foot into it. And that was 2014. And we found a house we're working with a friend who was a contractor. We found a house in a town called North Bend, and it was an old log cabin. It was over 100 years old. It had actually been brought down from Alaska. Someone had brought this thing from Alaska and set it up on the river there. So it had 150 feet of riverfront with it. And there, you know, I kind of had the desire to preserve this thing. So we brought it up and, you know, maintained as much of the wood and the character of that log cabin as we could while bringing it completely up to modern standards. And that was supposed to take 3 months, but it took 9, which is typical for flips and certainly for first flips, right?
Sure.
For things to take longer than they should. But I learned a lot from that, and we still turned a profit on it, but I knew I couldn't keep doing that. And I certainly couldn't keep doing it at the scale that it would take to create a quicker retirement or ability to step back from the practice. So I did that house flip. I took the lessons from that. And then shortly after that, I started moving into single family homes, purchasing those, because that was still really heavily in the content of podcasts at that time.
Right.
Was the recommendation to jump into single family homes and start buying as many as you could of these in different markets.
Mainly rentals, right? For the most part.
Yeah. To buy rental properties. And I did that in two ways. I bought houses that had been rehabbed. So in other words, properties that were flipped by turnkey providers, basically, where they would, you know, pick up some of the stuff that had come on the market after the 2009 debacle, right? And they would upgrade these things and then flip them to investors. I did buy some of those. And then I bought some new construction properties also. So they were single family homes, but they were new construction. And I bought those in Florida, and I bought other properties in Alabama and Illinois. So those were the markets that I researched and looked into at that time. And I jumped in and I bought 7 in about a year and a half.
Wow.
So I had my foot in the door for real estate. I loved it. I started to understand that I could do that while working, that I could hire other people to manage them, and I would manage the managers. And I chose very carefully what properties I bought. I still ran into a couple problems there. And if we get to a point in our conversation where we talk about mistakes, I can bring some of those up. But mostly I feel like I made good decisions for wading through it and the information that was available to me at the time. So I was pretty happy with that. So I jumped in and I did that. And then I really, you can only get 10 Fannie Mae loans, right? And I had used 7. Mm-hmm. So I've got 3 left. And it was pretty obvious that although there was some benefit to single family homes, they were going to scale very slowly. And I think one thing that we have to think about if we're old dogs, right, is that we don't have 25 years necessarily, right, for the houses to appreciate or pay down the mortgages, right? We usually, as we get older, we're a little bit more interested in cash flow than we are in appreciation. So I knew that this was going to scale pretty slowly. It was still okay. I can leave these for my daughter, for instance, right? But I was looking for a way to move this along faster. So I had 3 loans left and I used those to buy 4-plexes. So now I purchased 3 4-plexes, which are still bought with conventional loans. And this appealed to the solo practitioner in me. We tend to feel like we need and want to do everything ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have a little bit more trouble, you know, working as a team. We're good at it once we start, but we're kind of schooled and, you know, that we've got to do everything all by ourselves. So it appealed to me because I was still doing it by myself, but now I was in multifamily. And that was a light bulb that this was going to make a huge difference, because if 2 of the units were occupied, all the bills were paid.
Mm-hmm.
Versus a single family home, right, which is 100% vacant. When it's vacant and you're paying for the turn, right? You're still paying the mortgage when there are no tenants in there. And if anything goes wrong with a single family home, you might be out cash flow for the year or longer.
Right.
Depending on what it is. So here again, you're banking back on the appreciation of it rather than the cash flow. So the light bulb really went on when I got those 4-plexes. And that's when I looked into passive investing. That was the next step. I'd used my 10 Fannie Mae loans. So I looked into becoming a passive investor in multifamily syndication.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let's take a look at this now. You didn't invest in Washington at all, right? So everything was out of state. Okay. So that adds, you know, another element to this too. It's one thing, you know, when the property is down the street from you, but you are out of state investor. So you had to rely very heavily, I imagine, on your local management team, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Let's take a look at that. And I know you could probably talk about moving into the syndication thing, but first, you know, just again, you've got all at this time before you. Okay. So you've got 7 single family homes and then 3 4-plexes. And are they all, you know, fairly close to each other? Did you use the same management team? Did you have multiple management, multiple property managers, or how did you handle that?
In Florida, I was fortunate where one property manager is able to take care of all the properties there.
Oh,
and those
great.
Are in Ocala and Jacksonville. So I do have one property manager that covers both of those markets. So that was good. It is better. The less property managers you have to deal with, the better. And assuming, of course, that they're good, right? But the less you have to deal with, the better. The less paperwork, everything's just easier at tax time. So fortunately, I had that. And then I had one property manager in Illinois and one in Alabama, too. So I had 3 different property managers, one for each of those markets.
Gotcha. Well, let's take a look at the sort of the aspect here where, you know, we talked about mistakes. You just jumped into this. I mean, 7 houses in a year and a half. I mean, that's huge and a lot to take on while working full time. What were some of the mistakes that happened that you really learned from at that point?
Yeah, it was, you know, I would work all day and then I'd come home and I'd research real estate was how I did it, but it was fun. It's always been fun. Which is one of the ways I know how much I love real estate is even the bits that aren't fun are still fun somehow. So I was okay doing that in the evenings or, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm on my phone looking at stuff. And then I would call property managers during the day. And I did the due diligence that I could till I felt comfortable. And even so, mistakes can still happen. And that's true, I think, with the best research. We know this in multifamily, and I know you're in, or you are in multifamily still, right? And
yes.
So something's always going to happen, right? No matter how much you look at things. So one thing that happened was one of the houses that I bought in Illinois was actually sitting on two lots. And that wasn't disclosed to me by the seller. So what happens then is, of course, you have twice the tax rate that showed on the pro forma.
Oh, wow.
And the other thing that happened in Illinois, and I didn't know to ask this. It was a case of I didn't know what I didn't know, was that if you are an out-of-state owner, your taxes are doubled anyway. So if I had had just the one lot, my taxes from the pro forma would have been doubled, but I had two and those were doubled.
Ouch. Oh,
right?
Man.
Yeah. Yeah. So that hurt. And when I realized it, the underwriter missed it. The lender missed it. I had some people who were, you know, looking over advisors, you could say, that were looking over the property for me. They all missed it. It was amazing. I think I was meant to learn that lesson because it basically just got through every possible, you know, check and balance that could have found it. So now I had this property with sky high taxes. There was no cash flow from this house. I can't sell it to an investor because why would I do that, right? Due to someone what I had just got stuck with. And I couldn't sell it to a local person either because they need to qualify for their mortgage at the tax rate the owner is paying, even if they're in state and I'm out. So if you've got 10 similar houses, mine had an enormous tax bill and the others didn't. So mine didn't look so good. So a success I had, now if we, in a lemons to lemonade, right, kind of way, was that I worked out a strategy to get a tenant in there to rent to own it. And so I got the tenant in and he's paying rent, which is going toward the purchase price of the house. So he'll be purchasing the house in March. He's been basically paying down that purchase price for 2 years. So when he qualifies for the mortgage from the lender, the property will cost less than it will appraise for, and he'll have already paid a significant amount toward it. So that was how I fixed that problem.
Smart.
So we'll actually be able to sell that house. So I turned that, what looked like a really bad problem and something that I could have really been stuck with for a long time, into a success.
That's great. That's a fantastic approach. So it became a lease option type arrangement with them. Fantastic. And I guess at that point, you're just waiting to be able to unload this property, right? I mean, to get free from
finally,
that tax burden.
In March, right? I will be free of it. But that was definitely a lesson learned that, you know, this type of thing can happen, and to keep a certain amount of liquidity and cash reserves in case something like this comes up. So there were definitely lessons there.
Yeah, definitely. That's great. That's a really, really, that was a smart solution. Yeah. To be able to get off something that, you must've felt like you were trapped in.
Yeah. It was pretty shocking when I, you know, received the title document and I saw the two PIN numbers. That was how I thought, wait a minute, this can't be right. but it was.
Wow.
It was definitely right.
Well, so you kind of brought us a little bit up to date there. You went from the single family to the small multi, the fourplexes. But then you moved into syndication. You want to talk about that?
Yes. Syndication was the next logical step after I had used all 10 loans. And I had these properties that were bringing me rental income, and multifamily syndication provided some really good tax benefits for that as well. So it was a way for me to keep investing without having to do any additional work and receive the tax benefits that I could use to write off my rental income from the other properties. So it was just a win-win-win all around. And it's a completely different form of due diligence that I needed to learn. And I started going to a lot of conferences and seminars because I knew that I was going to ask what's next and eventually also want to become a GP because I just love real estate that much, and I like to keep going with it. And I've been an educator too in healthcare. I've been teaching seminars for 20 of the 25 years I've been in practice, and I enjoy that part. And I think, you know, like in your case, even you do a podcast, you're helping people get the same kind of results and wins that you've gotten. You know, you're speeding it up for them mm-hmm. by providing them information much earlier than we would have gotten it. Right. So when I was interested in real estate, this type of thing didn't even exist. And this is, it's great that it's here so we can tell people what we know and what we've learned and speed up their journey into this. So I have, that's another reason I'm happy to be part of this today and share my story and what I've been through. So I enjoyed passive investing a lot, and I enjoyed the returns. I enjoyed the tax savings, and I started looking into how can I do this too. And I did some coaching. I think the coaching is a good thing, definitely. So I did a year of kind of intensive coaching in how to become a general partner and what are the types of jobs and the work that everybody needs to do on that side of the fence. And then I really wanted to work, especially with healthcare providers, since those are my colleagues and the people that I mostly interacted with in my career, but they have a reputation, healthcare providers, and if they're listening right now, they know this to be true. They probably heard it, is that we have a reputation of being kind of stingy and hard to work with. And, you know, we just want to do everything ourselves, which I already admitted to. And I offered to different groups of general partners to actually come on and, you know, bring some of these contacts that I had. And I was just turned down. They wanted nothing to do with focusing on healthcare. But I was listening to a podcast, and my current partner, Sanjay Hegde, in Blue Ring Investors, he was on there, and his background is that he's a pharmacist. And so he also wanted to work with healthcare providers. And after I listened to his podcast, I called him. And we had a number of conversations over a period of months and finally decided that, yeah, we could work together. So that was about two and a half years ago. And we are Blue Ring Investors now, and it's been going great ever since.
Well, that's great. Now, are you primarily in multifamily?
Yes, we did do, in June of this year, we did become GPs on a 700-unit storage facility in outside of Asheville,
oh, great.
Or outside of Charlotte, rather. Sorry, Charlotte, North Carolina. So we did venture into that space because we had a really good opportunity to do that. But yes, we are primarily in multifamily value add.
And how many units currently are you in with the syndication?
We have 190 under management,
mm-hmm.
190 units under management, and we have a couple properties under contract right now as well. So it's, you know, during a pandemic, I sometimes wonder what it was like before the pandemic or what it will be like afterward. But for, you know, the conditions that we had, I feel like we're doing really well with it. And we've helped a lot of other people learn about this and get invested in these types of things. And we do mostly at this time 506B structured syndications. And I know you're familiar with that
right,
term.
Maybe you can clarify for our listeners.
I don't know if all the listeners are. Yeah. There are two main structures that you can use for a syndication. Those are 506B and 506C. With a 506C structure, you can advertise as you like. I can put a sign in my front yard if I want to that, you know, we have something under contract, but all the investors need to be accredited. And what that means is that they must have $1 million of net worth, not counting their own property. Or if they're single, they need to have $200,000 of income per year for the last 2 years with the expectation it will continue. Or if they're married, it's $300,000 for the last 2 years. So that's a high bar for people to meet. The other way that you can get into multifamily syndication is to be a sophisticated investor. And this is who the 506B structured deals are open to. 506C can invest in them too. But 506B deals are accredited investors rather are limited to these 506B type deals. So I enjoy these because the relationship.
Yeah, just to clarify there, so the 506B is exclusively not sophisticated investors. It's accredited investors only on Bs, right? And C.
C is accredited only.
Yeah, okay.
And B, accredited can go there too if they want to.
Right.
But the sophisticated investor is limited to the 506B.
Got it. Okay, great.
Structured deals. So what I like about that is I love building the relationship and doing the education part that's involved in these 506B deals, where in order to have an investor come into one of these deals with you, you need to have a pre-existing relationship with them, meaning you have to know them and know that they have enough information about investing and how multifamily works, for instance, experience with money, that they're making a good decision by coming into the investment. And I enjoy that process and working with colleagues that I've known for over 20 years to introduce them to this type of investing if they haven't heard of it themselves, because it's a way for them to get the benefits, just like I had, of having these investments going, cash flow going, but they don't actually have to put in any extra time to get there. And once they see it and see how it works and learn a few things about how to do their due diligence, most of them get pretty excited about it. And we tend to have people invest with us more than once.
That's the best way to do it. That's awesome.
So it becomes great. Like a family.
Yeah. And just to clarify at this point, so you still have your other 10 properties, right? The seven houses and the fourplexes?
Almost. I kept the fourplexes, and I will keep them. Mm-hmm. I kept the new construction single family homes, mm-hmm. but I have been selling the other single families, mm-hmm. and moving that money into syndication.
Gotcha. Okay. Good. And you're also still working full time?
I am. Yeah.
Wow. This is amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm still working full time. I enjoy it. You know, like I've been saying, you know, even at the beginning of the podcast, I really enjoy that work. And probably what I'm hoping to do, my husband and I, our daughter's got two more years of high school. We would really like to travel after that. So
awesome.
I'm working very hard as a syndicator now, and I'll probably do that for about, I'm thinking maybe 5 more years. And then I'll probably just move to full time back into passive investing. It is such a great space to be in. And I do think as we get older, I would steer people more away from buying single family and toward considering multifamily syndication investing, mm-hmm. for the cash flow and the lack of dealing with banks and the limited liability of it. There are just so many good reasons to be in the space. And now as a syndicator, I know how hard the partners and sponsors work to protect the investors' money and make sure that they get paid, you know, at least at pro forma, but we always want to do better than that. We always want to under promise and over deliver.
Exactly.
And we do that with very conservative underwriting. And right now in the current climate, since the Fed raised interest rates 2 times recently, there is a lot of fear. And I know that because I've, you know, personally felt it. It's hard not to get twinges of it when you hear this, but also from speaking to investors, I watched the conversation around investing change very suddenly after that happened. And so I've been researching this more and looking into this more. And what I would say, you know, there is a reason why the experienced and seasoned investors are still investing right now. And many of them are ramping it up. There's a reason for that. And it's that there's actually money to be made now. So the fear could make you miss that. You know, if you're in your fight or flight, right, and you choose the flight one, you can really miss out right now. So we, you know, as old dogs again, we don't have as much time to recover from a serious financial setback. So it's normal to have that fear. But again, I think if you do some education around it, if the fear is not appropriate, if it's not keeping you from making a mistake, if it's keeping you rather from doing something that would be good for you, then it's good to do a little bit more research on this. And the two things that I would say to look at are, one would be the relative stability that multifamily has had in past recessions. So, and I can talk a little bit more about that if that would be helpful. And the other is that you would make sure that there is more stress testing being done on properties that you're considering investing in. So in other words, your conversation with a syndicator would shift, you're not ignoring what type of returns you could get, but it would kind of shift away maybe from an emphasis there to emphasizing how your money is being protected by the syndicators.
Right, right. Good point. And in finding a good syndicator, I mean, can you give us maybe a couple of quick tips here on how somebody would go about finding a good syndicator or sponsor?
Sure. Yeah, you definitely want to interview that person. So you, in fact, on our website, we did a webinar. My partner recorded a webinar where he went over 40 questions that you should ask a syndicator. So that's something that people can get for free on our site. That's downloadable.
Great. That's great.
There. Yeah. Well, and that's a good place.
To that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good place to start. And sometimes, I've talked to investors who they'll ask me about 4 or 5 questions, and then they kind of feel like they're taking up too much of my time or something, so they'll apologize, where I'm completely happy. I wish we could stay on the phone for another hour, but they worry that maybe they're overstepping their bounds or something to be asking so many questions. But this is your hard-earned money, right, that you're thinking about giving to this syndicator. You should ask every question you have and then some, and then you should sleep on it and then ask them some more questions the next day.
Exactly.
Right? It's not a problem. If you were speaking to a syndicator and you got the feeling that you were annoying them, that would be a red flag for me.
Big time, yeah.
Right, to back away. So no, you should ask all the questions that you have. And one would be that the team is experienced in handling the types of market cycles that we're going through now, because these are completely normal. And we've had, I guess, since, if we look at the last 40 years, there have been 5 different recessions that have happened. So there was one, and all us old dogs have lived through all of them, right? There was the energy, around the energy crisis in the 80s, early 80s, the Iran energy crisis, 81, we had the Gulf War, there was a recession around that time after 9/11. And then, what they call the Great Recession, capital G, capital R, was December 2007 to 2009. So we've seen this before, and it's not our first rodeo with this type of thing. Every situation is a little bit unique, but we've seen this, and we know that multifamily tends to weather this type of thing. And the facts about it, just, you don't even need to do research to know this. It's from your own experience and logic, we know that during a recession, people try to save cash and cut spending. So they'll cut going out to dinner, and they'll cut movies, and they'll travel less, but they'll still need a place to live. So that's one thing that doesn't get cut. It's harder during a recession for people to qualify for mortgages. So it's harder to get a loan. So there are probably less people buying homes at that time. And multifamily usually has a larger tenant base than, say, an office space. So maybe in an office space, you have 2 or 3 people working. In a multifamily community, you might have 100 units there. And currently, on top of the recession, of course, we're also dealing with a pandemic. So people are less likely to move and relocate during that time. And all of these things make multifamily strong now, and have made it strong through the other market cycles where we've been dealing with with recessions. And that's just the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Those are things, but we don't need to go to that website, I think, to understand it. So there are places, though, you know, if you want statistics on it or official things where you can look at, like the CBRE, which is the it's an American company. It's the Commercial Real Estate Services and Investment Firm, I think is the full name of CBRE. Mm-hmm. So it's Coldwell Banker, Richard Ellis, right? And they, they're the largest commercial real estate broker, I think, right up through at least 2021. So they provide a lot of statistics and data on housing. And they showed, if I actually went back and looked at the 2008-2009 Great Recession to see what they said about that. And they showed that rents for apartments were more resilient than any other property type at that time. And that when the recession finally ended, rent growth for multifamily outpaced other property types. So we can look back and see these things, and it helps to create some confidence if you're feeling like you want to move ahead. So Warren Buffett said, be greedy when others are fearful, right? And fearful when others are greedy. So the fear is here right now. So he and certainly other smart people would say to move forward with it. And then another great place to go for statistics, you know, would be the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries. So they all have these complicated long names, right? But it's NCREIF. So they track performance of commercial real estate too. And they also, you know, they give indexes that the industry uses to evaluate one type of property against another, and they've shown multifamily also weathering these storms. So I think that education and the peace of mind and realizing that in the last 40 years, we've been through this five times before, lets us know that we'll get through this one too. These types of cycles are normal.
That's great. Great advice. Well, speaking of advice, you know, this is our audience primarily are folks that are either approaching retirement or already in retirement, and they're looking at real estate investing as a means to either, you know, grow their existing nest egg or maintain that nest egg, or to create additional cash flow. And what advice would you have for those folks that are, you know, just kind of looking at real estate and looking to make that a significant part of their retirement?
I'm following my own advice here too. I explained why I really think single family, people make it work. It can happen. Maybe especially if you could pick up, say, a small portfolio of houses in an area near you, or, you know, if something like that. But a lot of good luck has to happen. Probably good luck and hard work to make that occur. So the other way that I would say to go, and I have been doing for the last 5 years, intend to keep doing, would be passive investing. It's just the easiest way to get the returns without the work. If you decide you want to go live in Portugal for a year, it would be harder to do that if you were managing physical properties yourself. Even if you had to manage managers, it could still be harder. If you had passive income, you really have the time freedom and location freedom to go do those types of things. And then you can just keep rolling syndications into the next syndication. So it can actually be a really simple way. And the barrier to get in can be about the same as a single family home. So say you find a single family home for $100,000 or $125,000, and you had to put $20,000 down, right? Or $25,000 down even, you can get into multifamily for that same amount of money. But you don't have to worry about the roof leaking or the property managers not doing their jobs or that type of thing. So I'm definitely like that space. That's why I'm in it. And I'm walking my talk there. So that's what I would tell people to do.
That's great. And looking ahead, what is your goal? It sounds like you want to eventually sell the fourplexes now and the rest of the single family and be exclusively in syndication. Is that right?
I'll keep I will sell a couple more of these single family homes. I will keep the ones that were new construction because they don't need any significant work and they won't for a while. So as long as those keep cash flowing and aren't any trouble and someone doesn't knock down my door with an offer I can't refuse on them, I will hang on to those. But other than that, yes, I am really going kind of full force into syndication, both passively and actively.
Great. Great. Well, our time together has kind of zipped by here really quickly. A lot of great.
It has. It went so fast.
Great information. I am like I think this is going to be a lot of good stuff for folks, especially people that are trying to decide. But we have a little segment we call the Wrap It Up, and where you can share resources that you have utilized in the past. And if you want, we can go ahead and wrap it up.
Okay.
Favorite real estate book?
Multiple streams of income. It's a thick book, but the mindset that it created was really good. If you're thinking the right way, it's easier to find the information that you need.
Yeah, that's great. It is a great book, and not a lot of folks mention that, but I think it's that's an excellent resource. Favorite business book?
15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership.
Oh, great.
That is a fantastic book. The author is Jim Dethmer. It's Dethmer.
How about most valuable website for success? A website that you just go to all the time that's invaluable to you?
For me, that's been LinkedIn.
Oh, really? Great. Is that, potential new investors? How does that work with you as far as something that you find great value in?
I think it does a couple things. Well, three things. One is it's a networking site, which is good. And it's a network site for professionals. So people aren't saying, I went to this restaurant, or I'm doing my laundry, the kind of stuff you hear on Facebook sometimes. So it's just a professional site. And people can also, if you publish on there and you write, some things that you've learned in business, or you offer people tips or things that will help them, it helps you build a network where people know more about who you are. And then they can decide, right, to click through to your site. But you want people to know you and you what kind of your consistent message is. And LinkedIn, I think, is a great way to do that. So I wish I was posting more on it. I try to get on there at least once or twice a month, but I know a lot of people like Facebook. I've never clicked real well with Facebook, so I'm just not on there much, but LinkedIn I do really like.
That's excellent. What about favorite app on your phone?
Probably, yeah, either Audible or podcasts. I'm learning on there as much as I can.
Okay, great. How about a favorite quote?
The best investment on earth is earth.
I love it. I love it. That's a great quote.
And that's Louis Glickman. He was a New York real estate investor from Brooklyn.
Excellent. Excellent. And final question, if you lost all of your assets and you had to start over knowing what you already know, and but you only have $1,000 in cash, what would you do with that $1,000 to relaunch your real estate investing business?
I would immediately start building or rebuilding my network.
That's great. That's great.
Multifamily is a team sport.
Big time. Yes.
Right. And we are, and this is contractors, property managers, investors, general partners, the tenants in the property, right? Everybody is benefiting if we do our job well.
That's great. It is people business more than anything else, I think. So I agree with you on that one. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of folks listening that would love to connect with you and or maybe ask you, questions or, find out about what you're doing or projects you're involved with. What's the best way for folks to reach you?
That would be through our website, which is www.blueringinvestors.com. Awesome. We have a lot of free information on the site, and there is a Calendly link there. And I am very happy to spend time on the phone and answering questions and sharing what I know and what I've learned. And anyone can schedule right through that site.
Great. Great. Well, I know you've listened to this show before, so you probably know what is next. And go for it.
Ow!
That's good.
I think I scared my dog. Or she was thinking, I can do better, right?
Oh, that's so funny. That's great. Well, wow, Jeanette, this has been awesome having you on. What a thrill, and what a lot of great information for our listeners. I can't thank you enough for joining us.
Well, so much fun for me too. I get to check a box now because I have wanted to be on your show and get the chance to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you. And I want to thank all our old dog listeners out there too for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we really appreciate it. Now, please note everything that Jeanette talked about, especially the links and some of the valuable resources she has available, can be found in our detailed show notes on the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. And you're going to look for the episode with Dr. Jeanette Birnbach. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.